It's time for Sports Lit 101. Bruce Pratt in the house with us, as always, on Wednesdays. And we're happy to welcome to the program Stephen Hardy. He's the author and co-author of a number of books and articles on the history of sport, including Hockey, A Global History. He is a coached and supervised college hockey for many, many years, currently working as a professor as well. And he's the author of a terrific book that we talked about recently, The Commissioner, A Sports Mystery. Stephen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Rich. Appreciate it.
I like that you've taken a number of your passions and put them into one work, and boy, it is a fun ride along the way, and even more so for anybody familiar with hockey in this neck of the woods.
Well, I'm glad you like it. That means a lot.
One of the things...
Go ahead.
Now, one of the things that I think Rich and I both found fascinating was trying to figure out just how much of Towne and Farnham and other people might have been drawn from real life figures that we might all have known in the hockey world in the Northeast, and it was really fun. I'd say that's Jack Parker. Oh no, it's not. That's Sherry. Oh, no, it's not. That's Sean Walsh. No, it's not. You've created these great figures, but what is they seem so real because the whole way you describe college hockey is exactly my experience.
Well, I appreciate that. It means a lot coming from someone who knows the literature as well as you do, Bruce. It was fun to create these characters, and you know, fiction, a lot of it comes from the life experience of the writer, but they're all mashups, as you know. I have very much enjoyed some of my friends telling me who's who, and I tell them I'm going to keep quiet. I like this conjuring who's who, and when I'm working on a prequel, and I try to get a real picture of someone. In this case, it wouldn't have been any of these real people, but some kind of coach, and I have that picture in my mind when I find the image that seems to suit that character. Sophia Awad was a good example. It took me a long time to get an image of someone who I wanted to be, Sophia Awad. But it's fun. Having been a historian for many years working in these areas, I think it's a lot more fun to be able to use your imagination in fiction. And these next two books are historical prequels, so that gets me using the historical research tools that I'm so used to using, but it's still going to be fiction.
Well, and I think there's this, what makes this book, what positions it in I would say a unique place in hockey literature is we have there's been a lot of great hockey fiction over the years, no doubt about that, but there hasn't really been a mystery. You know, there have been mysterious things. I think that the last season, there are mysterious things about what happens to Felix Badarinsky and the like. But the other thing is, hockey has been, in the national eyes, not nearly as prone to scandal and intrigue as some of the other major college sports, in part because it doesn't play on as big a stage in people's minds. But college hockey's been a cleaner thing than college football or college basketball over the years. And to come at this the way you did, where it's the outside influences that seem to be causing the original problem, was I haven't seen that before in a hockey book, and I'm wondering when that sort of came to your mind.
Well, as you know, and I think you're correct, that in many cases, the problems in college sports are really fermented and imposed by outsiders. That's a common theme. I taught for several years out at the University of Washington. When I was there, their head football coach was Don James, and he had brought the Huskies back to the glory days, if you will, and in those days that meant going to the Rose Bowl. And I had some players in class, and I was really impressed with how important he was making academics to those student athletes. And you can't fake that. They weren't just blowing it up at me. And I remember writing to Don James. Well, if you recall, it was about late 80s or 90s. I was gone. I was at UNH by that time. And their quarterback ended up being exposed for taking money back home from some booster. And there's no way you could control that. If a booster really wants to funnel money to an athlete, there's no way to prevent that. And Don James, a highly successful coach, ended up resigning. He wasn't forced to resign, but he thought that the punishment imposed was way beyond the crime. And I knew for sure, here's a guy who stood for all the values everybody should be standing for in college athletics, and yet his program was sullied, and he ended up leaving coaching for something that there's no way in the world he could have prevented.
Well, that's the other thing I really like about the book, Stephen, is that the outside pressures, none of the coaches or even the ADs in some cases can control when there's enough money. And for a long time, money wasn't being funneled into college hockey the way it was being funneled into the other sports. But there has been some thought that might be changing.
Yes, but remember, I was the supervisor, was the title, and the assistant commissioner of the ECAC in the late 70s. And there was some great hockey. Now, Maine just started back hockey. Jack Semler was right. The first coach in 78. And they clearly were on a fast track to go to Division I. And then Jack got them on the course, and Sean brought them to the promised land, so to speak. But then they had their own problems.
Yeah.
And I was a faculty rep at UNH for 15 years. You can't escape having problems. You do your best. If you went back to the 70s, when I was working in the field, there were issues. And you're right, college hockey was nothing like what you saw in other sports, particularly basketball or football. But if you talk to the coaches, they all would say, well, look what goes on there. What's going on over there? What's going on over there? You know, what are you guys doing? And what was going on, it was not like what was happening at other sports at the big time, but there were always rumors going on. And so when I left the ECAC and started out at the University of Washington, I had an hour bus ride each way. We lived on the east side of Lake Washington. And that's when I started making notes. And the notes provided a core. But the book, I really didn't work in earnest on this book until I had a sabbatical in the mid or late 90s. And that was one draft. And then a second draft was sometime in the 2000s. And along the way, I lost two sons. So that's why grief is such a part of this book. I had you may even know the name, Bruce, a colleague down here, Don Murray, who has had a lot to do with the development of teaching writing. He's dead now, but he became my friend. He had lost his daughter. We would go out to lunch, and he told me, you've got to feed the beast. Feed the beast.
Yeah.
Bring it into the book. Bring it into your writing. So as with any book, I think for a writer like me, it takes a long time and many various drafts of this thing. But I think I'm happy with what we have now, and I'm glad you are. You and Rich enjoyed it, too.
We're talking with Stephen Hardy about his book, The Commissioner, A Sports Mystery. And you mentioned that this is also a book about loss, and that gives it an added depth as well, and also the role that sport can play in the healing process.
No question. No question. My youngest son was a Navy SEAL, and he was killed in action in 2008. And we've been involved in charities that help veterans. And I was just with some guys, Bruins alums, Frank Simonetti. And the Bruins alums are very involved in helping veterans. But we were talking about healing. And in many ways, the SEAL teams are small units, and they're able to process their losses, and their losses proportionally have been the highest of any military, because we're using more special operations. There aren't many of them. And proportionally, they just keep losing their friends, but they stay back at it. And it's much like hockey. And they're using around the country, we're supporting warrior hockey teams. And so being on the ice is allowing people to process loss. So it is very helpful. There's no question about it, Rich.
I felt that the pace of the book at times really was like a hockey game. You know, it's the only sport where you can just go over the boards and jump back, and as soon as somebody else comes off, no timeout, no whistle has to blow. It's, you know, you don't need to make an official substitution. And I thought that as we got on towards the climax, that I was constantly watching the line changes coming over the boards. And I don't know if you did that purposely, but it really felt that way as I was reading. And I thought, I filed that away. I said to myself, remember that, Bruce. Next time you're writing a hockey story, think about this.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. In your world of sport lit, I know one of the mantras is that if you really want to call it sport lit, then you have to somehow engage the reader in the world of sport. And that's what I've tried to do. I also, you're picked up something that I'm really happy you did. In Shakespeare, as you know, there's the whole notion of the play within the play.
Exactly.
And so I tried to have the game within the game. So I'm glad you picked up on that.
Yeah, it's funny. I just came from a playwriting class where I said to the kids, the play is the thing when we'll catch the conscience of the king. And
there you go.
And when you look at the last game that we see played and the rest of the story starts to unfold, I think it was just a masterful way of talking about that there is the game and then there's the not the game. And I always think of Farewell to Arms as that way. There's the war and there's not the war. But here we have the game and the not the game, but you can never separate them. They're stuck together just like Velcro.
No, that's right. And especially if you have to watch out for the goal judge. And just yesterday, a friend of mine, an old friend of mine from those days who's been involved in college hockey for a long time, he pointed to another school in the league who is notorious for questionable goal judges.
Yeah. Well, my friend Bill Craver, who I went to prep school with, used to be a goal judge at the Whittemore. And of course, being a Maine guy, it was whenever we go to a reunion, I'd say, you know, Bill, I think you missed one against us the other day. He'd go, Bruce, the goal judge is never credited with being really good.
No, that's true. Let me make a shout out to Sean. One of the great masters of the tactical end of ice hockey. I don't know if you were down at, it was 2001 maybe, his last Hockey East championship, I believe. They beat BC at the end of the game.
Yeah, I wasn't, I watched the game on television, but.
My son and I were there. It's the end of the game, the score is tied, and it's a face-off down in the BC zone. Sean calls a timeout, brings the team over, he's got the chalkboard, and I said to my son Ben, who was into soccer, college soccer coaching by that time, I said, watch this, something's going to happen. And sure enough, they pulled the pick, face-off, bing, 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 the pick worked, a legal pick, score, and wins. And you know that plays a part. That recollection of mine is part of the book.
Yep.
When you watch that kind of tactical genius, and a guy who could come down here into the Whittemore Center and use the big ice to Maine's advantage, and there weren't many teams that could do that, but he did that.
His former player and now coach of the ECHL team in Portland, Ben Gitte, and I were in school at the same time. He was obviously an undergraduate. And I remember him just saying that you never felt, he said in a tie game with 6 seconds to go, it would be one of us not doing the right thing, not Sean drawing up the wrong play. And I thought about that a lot since then.
Yeah. There have been some terrific coaches in Hockey East and the ECAC, and as I say, if you often, when you're in the background with them, they'll always be saying, well, wait a minute, how did that kid get up there? How did that kid get here? How did that? And they're all saying the same thing. So it evens out, I guess.
Oh, I know. I had Red Gendron say to me about a kid one time that went somewhere else. Said, I thought we had him. I don't know who the hell got to him.
Yeah, but there are, it's a, still, I think, the college coaching cohort is a wonderful group. There's always going to be some grumbling from older people that it's a bunch of sharks coming in now, and I'm sure that's what they were saying back in the early 60s when the old gentleman coaches like Cooney Weiland were passing the baton slowly to the younger generation like a Jack Kelly or a Charlie Holt or a Sid Watson at my alma mater, Bowdoin. And then as they got older, they watched the younger generation. But hockey's still pretty close, a close group that really doing a lot of good on these campuses.
Well, it's a wonderful read and obviously well-researched, well, through your life. and it comes through in every page of the book, The Commissioner, A Sports Mystery. Stephen Hardy, thank you for making time to talk with us about it this afternoon.
Thank you, Rich, and thank you, Bruce, for having me back.
We'll do it again sometime. You got two more books coming.
Thank you. Yes, down the road.
We'll look forward to it. Thank you, Stephen.
Yep, thank you. Bye-bye.
Stephen Hardy with us here on Downtown, talking about The Commissioner. And again, you followed hockey in the Northeast.
Yeah.
You're going to recognize some people and some things. You just may not be able to put your finger on who is who.
Right, and I think the great thing is because Stephen has experience as a UNH guy and working with the ECAC. So he's seen all the coaches in the Northeast, mm-hmm. New York and New England coaches. You know, and he's right. That, you know, the coaches will grumble, but I've never heard any coach at Maine badmouth another coach. He'll say, that guy's a shark sometimes. But geez, he's a good coach, right? And I think that comes out. What happens is there are antagonists and protagonists, but this comes out with human people at the end. There's a great sense of humanity in this book, and I really like that.
What's coming up next week on Sports Lit?
Well, right now I'm pouring through three different books about March Madness and its antecedents and the like, and I think probably I'm going to settle on one that says college basketball before March Madness. It's a little on the academic side, but there's a lot of, and the early part plows old ground that we know about from other books we've talked about. But the more updated stuff, the more interesting stuff, they're quoting people like Travis Vogan and people that we've had on, so that. They're looking at modern sources, so I'm hopeful that I'll be up to snuff on that. There's some reading ahead.
Excellent. Well, we'll look forward to it.